Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are in the throes of heading into the ratification debate. And so what we're doing is we're kind of laying out the philosophical and the paradigm of government in Western society from the origins of man coming into the what we call the cradle of civilization, where the concepts of statism and liberty and all those types of things really started taking hold, and the advancement of politics and government really started taking a bigger drive. Instead of having just kings, there was actually laws. Now, you understand, common law and the essence of common law comes from the Judeo, and I'll just say from Israel. It was derived as a part of the law of, let's just say, the land, as Mr. Alan Winters basically lays it out. And we've had him on before talking about this. Now, the law of the city, or civil law, is something that started to become an innovation in government, and it was definitely something that came from Rome and Roman law, or civil law. And so, as Western society developed, there was a split between these two laws, and England and Britain clung to common law. France, Italy, and those that were, I'll just say, steeped by the Roman Catholic Church of the Roman Empire, they integrated civil law, because basically it was over the Roman Empire that civil law started to become a prevalent paradigm. And as a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. Historians point to civil law as let's just call it several law, where it is inseparable. And so what they claim is that the first time property became several law, or became one of those things that you are the owner, you have the title, maybe not a formal title, but this is your land. And back in those days, they didn't have titles and deeds, but they kind of registered that this was your land. And once you made a claim to that land, because at that point in time, it's not like there was a real estate agent that was kind of open for business back in Adam's day, and as man started moving forward, monarchs used to claim their kingdoms and so forth, and they used to own all the land, except for sometimes they would respect some of the landowners that as they conquered other lands, but eventually they would assume control over everything. Now, in Roman law, they recognized land ownership and property ownership. And the historians marvel at the concept that, we had advanced to this level, but they completely ignore common law and how common law under the Ten Commandments, even before the Ten Commandments, there was a recognition of what your property was. And it acknowledged that to take somebody else's property was stealing, a sin. It was theft. And so the establishment of law really comes more from, like I said, it comes from Israel and I will just say the beginning of the creation from Adam and so forth. And a lot of records and documents and so forth were either not made, not available, or destroyed. One of the things, and it's worth going into, one of the things that you can learn as you study history, and J.M. Roberts points this out in the history of the world, because he tries to create a conclusive history of the entire world from creation. And J.M. Roberts is a guy that believes he descended from rodents and the evolutionary process. And so that to each their own, based on what makes them feel good and helps them sleep through the night, right? But one of the things he points out is that the Egyptian Empire, as it reigned the earth, it actually went out of its way to kind of document and record the history of ancient civilization, especially the ancient Mesopotamia, which was actually something that, you know, existed before the flood. And they actually had documents, and or somehow they captured the evidence and information of some of those ancient societies, because they recorded some of the cultures, which was kind of interesting. Because this ancient Mesopotamia that Egypt happened to recognize, or I should say not recognize, they took chronological records and so forth of these ancient societies, and they recorded some of their cultures and beliefs. And those who lived before the flood, believe it or not, believed in, and the way he spells this out, he's talking about the Godhead, right? He talks about the Creator. He talks about a mediator, that through him all can be saved, which points to Christ. And then they talk about another being that is the, you know, the teacher, comforter, inspirer, that's the Holy Spirit. And it's really interesting how, you know, here he is reporting something that actually proves to the fact that ancient history, these people that lived before the Egyptian Empire, and the Egyptian Empire, who had no agenda whatsoever to record this or to change the evidence that they found, they just recorded it. And so as he's kind of talking about, you know, these core beliefs of this ancient society, he just completely, either he misses it or he glosses over the fact that, you know, they recorded that the concept of the Godhead even predates ancient Egypt. And I'm going, how did he miss that? Well, you know, when your eyes are filtered and tuned a certain way, you know, it's like polarizing your glasses or what have you so that it can, you know, remove glare in certain directions, and the common directions horizontally. And so when you've got a horizontal paradigm, then you only see things at the horizontal plane, if vertical. And so, you know, when you truly believe and you embrace the concept of evolution, that you are a descendant of, you know, rodents and amphibians and so forth, then you'll believe anything. But when you actually start learning, you can, and you understand through the spirit, I just get a little spiritual here, but when you experience and have the spirit testify or give you that witness or what have you, so that you know what the truth is, it's really hard. Once you start having those types of experiences, it's really hard to ignore those. I mean, I'll just say you do that at your own peril. But anyway, so we kind of left off where, you know, we've gone from the paradigm of individual liberty, or the fullness of liberty and the fullness of subjugation, these two philosophies, and how mankind kind of struggled. I mean, there's always been a struggle over this concept of slavery, compulsion, making people do things. As I say in my book, the first commandment that was broken was the commandment that man must live by the sweat of his brow, because one of the first things that occurred that was, you know, most historians can point to, that slavery has existed for over 5,000 years. And so it's clear that it didn't take man long to try to figure out how to get other people to work by the sweat of their brows so that you could live, and basically sidestepping that concept that you're actually earning for yourself, you're taking care of yourself, and you are doing these things yourself, instead of forcing other people to do your bidding for you, do your work for you. But anyway, I digress. What we want to do is we want to kind of get into the later evolution of government and these concepts of individual liberty as we start talking, and how they dovetail with what we call natural law. So as you know, because we've got to cover all of these types of things, this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, as well as this concept that this show is still the only show that provides you academic evidence and the academic evidence-based solutions of what we need to do to get the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. We have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And by all means, we would beg you to reach out to your like-minded friends, family, and other people that would be interested in actually partaking, drinking from the fountain, that there's actually a solution, that the Constitution and the way it was designed lends to the only solution that will save this constitutional republic, which is republic review. Now, as we said, we kind of left off covering the scale of liberty, and now we're kind of in the midst of natural law. And what we want to do is we kind of want to cover where, you know, where we're going with this. And I left off in talking, in talking about the progressive transitions of government and so forth. So when we come back, I'll kind of take a little lead back from where we left off and move forward going into the Enlightenment era for natural law and society. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, as I was saying, the penultimate end, so the penultimate being the one before the last, the penultimate end for secular progressives, or their penultimate goal, is to transition all governments into centralized states. And yesterday, or in the previous episode, I should say, we already pointed to the United States has already been moved into a centralized state, into a centralized government, contrary to its design and the constitutional framework. The ultimate end, the final end, is to unify all states into a single governing body of the world. Now, I point this out, and I want you to think about the Constitution as the guide for the global governance of mankind. clearly within the Constitution in Article 4, the United States can allow states into the Union. However, Congress needs to stipulate those preparatory phases for them to become a party to the compact. Now, you got to understand, a state is not a subordinate to the federal government. When the federal government brings states in, it needs to prepare those states to be fully capable of becoming a parent and or what we would call an equal party in this compact. Because that was the intent, that the states were to be sovereigns. There was never and zero dialogue in the ratification debates that new states coming into the Union would be subjugated or would be subordinate to the federal government. At contrary, the concept was that all states would come in with equal footing. Anyway, so the ultimate end, again, is to basically unify states under this single governing world or the single governing body for the whole world. And the U.S. Constitution was already a document that allowed that, but that was a document of liberty. The concept of communism is not liberty to allow people to choose for themselves. What kind of world would we have if people were able to make their own decisions? So this idea has been around for a very long time. And as a matter of fact, I even pointed out that going back to the 14th century, where Dante's De Monarchia, and that is something that actually, if I remember correctly, Dante got banished, or he was punished by the, I'll just say, the powers that be of the Roman Empire and the Roman Catholic Church, because it was considered heresy, almost. And so because he published that book, he was kind of banished. I forget how many years he was banished, but then he was able to come back in. But this work, along with other ancient texts, such as Plato's Republic, has been the catalyst for the initial concept of the Illuminati, socialism. This is what we kind of covered in haste in the previous episode. So this blueprint for statism, communism, Platonism, whatever you want to call it, has been the catalyst, and Plato's Republic has really been the foundation for this initial concept of the Illuminati, socialism, communism, and all forms of government that violates the individual liberty and individual sovereignty of the citizens. Taking the Enlightenment era even further, the Magna Carta was a significant catalyst for the Enlightenment era, which began around the 13th century, I'm sorry. It was in 1215 when the Magna Carta was specifically signed. This is where King John had to proclaim specific liberties to the people and accepted the people's assertion that his wills and laws were not arbitrary. The problem was that when they created constitutions and laws, at that point in time, they still were granting general powers. So later, the English developed the common law system, where precedence in ruling and jurisdiction was established. This governance by kings, and by the way, I just want to be clear, precedence and jurisdiction and those types of rulings of case law is not integrated into the Constitution. So anyway, the governance by kings was the beginning of codifying or basically systematically creating levels of liberty to its citizens. These were not absolute liberties, and eventually the people of England had to revolt, and in 1688, they overthrew King James. This was the entrance, or actually this was the spawning of the Bill of Rights in England, and significant events in the evolution of Jefferson and our framers' interpretation of natural law. During the beginning of Enlightenment, scholars read and wrote about natural law, including the early founders of its philosophy. As I've listed in a lot of different works and a lot of other historians, they basically point to Thomas Aquinas, Francis Suarez, Richard Hooker, Thomas Hobbes, Hugo Grotius, Samuel von Pufendorf, and I'm sorry, I'm gonna murder some of these names, but John Locke, Francis Hutcheson, Jean-Jacques Burlamaqui, Emmerich de Vattel, and even Francis Bacon, William Blackstone, Baron de Montesquieu. Though they began to discover that Aristotle was wrong about all of the scientific laws, his philosophy was emphasized. The distinction of nature from man's law was, which was the law of nature, remained consistent where man's law changed. So that's the one thing that we have in contrasting common law to civil law. Common law is the same today as it was hundreds of years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, where civil law has changed, where before, they allowed you to have wells and they allowed you to do this and that, but now, that's not good, and we can't allow you to drain the aquifers. We can't allow you to do things that, we claim are doing bad, or they claim, science and what have you. So, as you can see, there's a consistency, and in Christianity, and I think in Judaism, you can, find a constant, that God's laws are always constant, that you can always recognize, that this is, because of its consistency, it's of Him. This also applied to God's law and its consistencies. These pioneers of natural law, argued that man possessed a much higher capacity, one that could discern and reason, a consciousness that could not be constrained on a physical plane and was capable of knowing good from evil, thus giving every man a freedom to choose right from wrong. Even societies and cultures that had disparate religious and philosophical ideologies were capable of determining good from evil as it pertained to both cultures and to God's law that were biblically based, such as thou shalt not kill. That was a common law that spanned several different cultures, thus giving man the moral freedom to choose when not subjected to austere oppression or handicapped with mental abnormalities, such as natural or drug-induced abnormalities. Over time, these laws took social prominence where men were awakening to the reality of their liberties, being constrained or being taken. So as people started recognizing, hey, we should be able to, freely do this. Why is it that we can't, practice this religion? In essence, these laws were constant, and obviously the laws or boundaries that God had provided as a framework of His gospel. Excuse me. An ideology that is in conflict with both natural and God's laws back in those days was something simple as homosexuality. For illustration purposes, the following is going to provide you with an example of the conflict of homosexuality in society as a sin and as a detriment is provided for consideration. Furthermore, this example will support an assertion of the National Secular Church that I have an article, and I wrote about this in my book, and I've got an article that's a long, it's like a mini book, but I basically break down how the government went from a government of, I don't want to say laissez-faire, but the federal government had very distinctive powers, and as it started accumulating and assuming powers, one of the first powers it started creating in the Progressive Era was its own secular church, which is why they've constantly ruled in, for a long time in favor that you can't have the separation of church and state and laws that were based on that paradigm, which is directly contrary to the framers and how they developed our constitutional framework. So in other words, sexual deviance is the antithesis of human survival and the propagation of the human race. Historically, deviant sexual practices, such as homosexuality, begin to rear its head as a tolerated amusement in Greece, in the ancient society of Greece, and in other early societies, these types of deviant practices, again, were amusements to people. I mean, how could that person do that? You know, and it was just amazements and that type of thing, especially during times of opulence. And you can look at societies. As societies became opulent, all of a sudden these types of things started creeping in. Within the paradigm that is shared by most historians, well, let me repeat that when we come back from these two breaks. So we will be right back after these two promos. Please stay tuned, and we're going to kind of wade through the Enlightenment era and the paradigm of natural law. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so, as we were just kind of pointing out, that homosexuality kind of surfaces when a society reaches a level of opulence and productivity, so that it seems like people don't have to work as hard, and they can spend more effort and time on leisure than they do. I mean, look at our society today. Look at kids today. How many kids have learned or understand the importance of work? This is child abuse, my friends. If you're not teaching your children a good work ethic and the importance of work and an honest day's work, it's child abuse, because you're just allowing them to, I guess, enable their own debauchery or their immature ideas and thoughts. So anyway, one of the things that is shared by most historians is that the building block for society is the family. In context of the term family, a family refers to the genetic background of a person's father and mother and heritage. Historians discuss the religious aspects and society who embraced all forms of debauchery, rejecting the family and property, all of which these societies went extinct. The word extinct is key here, which is precisely how Ludwig von Mises, and if you've ever read his treatise on socialism, he actually covers, you know, societies that were based on homosexuality that literally just died. I mean, they were either overthrown and they were destroyed, went extinct. I mean, there's never, Ludwig von Mises points out that there has never been a successful society that was able to rise like every other society that was based on debauchery that did not use the family as the nucleus of society. And so he referred to these as perverted ideologies. As a society which has risen to its heights of enlightenment of individual liberty and individual individual sovereignty, are we really going to embrace the destructive ideologies and selfish conceits that have destroyed other previous societies? Of course, unless we place these practices into proper perspective, a perspective that labels these acts as destructive to oneself and society. As progressives have monopolized the classrooms, their paramount goal since the early days of the Fabian movement back at the end of the 19th century was to debase procreation as a mere physical act and destroy the family. They have been able to do this by obscuring historical data and facts and encouraging sexual indulgence. Consequently, as long as society continues to allow the progressives to monopolize the narrative, ignoring history and denying the existence of empirical data from a plethora of previous cultures and society, the highly impressionable youth will adhere to the progressive scripts again and again. Censorship of information and projecting a biased narrative to promote one's end has been a successful practice for thousands of years. The concept of homosexual parents should have, the concept of homosexual parents should be an insult to practicing homosexuals by embracing the repulsive concept of byproduct of heterosexuality. In other words, if something really appeals to you of homosexuality, then the idea of heterosexuality would be repugnant, and the byproduct of that is children, and an insult to all children. As a technologically advanced society, we may have harnessed technology to do amazing things. However, we cannot deny the nature and natural law of children and family. Just because we can technically kill a person on an operating table and bring them back to life, like in the movie Flatliners, simply for the experience, does not mean this is a good or moral thing to practice in society. Again, children are a byproduct of heterosexuality and the course of procreation and the perpetuation of the species. Furthermore, homosexuality defies the makeup of the aforementioned family, its tree, and it perverts the posterity of future generations. If continued, there will not be a posterity for those genetic lines unless one continues to trace the genetics of the egg and donors, the different donors, for medical genetic traits and potential mates. Not doing this could result in brothers and sisters unknowingly breeding in a test tube. Now, I know that we've grown quite a bit as a society, but we are debasing ourselves when we enable bad behavior. Bottom line, when it comes to natural law, I can't emphasize enough. If something does not elevate society in strengthening the family, which is the nucleus of society, in strengthening productivity, in strengthening, the spiritual or the moral essence, the mores, that's what the Alexis de Tocqueville called them, the mores of society. If we're not strengthening and building and becoming more enlightened and in study, and becoming what I would say more and more intelligent and well educated. How many times have you been entertained by watching, whether it be Johnny Carson, Jay Leno, or whoever the night comedians are, and taking men out onto the street or a person on the street and asking people, questions that an educated person should know. And here are people that have graduated, that are out working. They look like they're being able to take care of themselves. I mean, it's not like they're interviewing those who are trapped in the homeless society of drug addiction and so forth. These people are somehow paying for something in their life. They're functioning as like a self-determinant body, but they're incapable of answering rudimentary questions. There is a plethora of works which illustrates that the greatest joy in life from a family overcoming the challenges in life. Therefore, one can understand the desire to partake in this, since well over a millennia, everyone's origins fundamentally have come from the components of a family. This is not to say that orphans or adopted children are not a part of the family. They are. They, unfortunately, are the results of a man and woman who did not adhere to enlightened behavior, because the enlightened behavior is what is best for themselves, their offspring, and society. Enlightened behavior is not selfish behavior, what's best for me. Selfishness is the debasement of society. And this is why we see these enabled children in school systems acting like babies and infants that they want to have, you know, I want you to call me this because call me they, and this kind of crap. That is not enlightenment. That is debasement. We are heading, or they are taking our society in the absolute opposite direction of entitlement. It's called debasement or debauchery. For those who cling onto the genetic fate, this could be considered a design to challenge one's character, or are we going to accept that all men want to commit adultery? And so we should just accept adultery, right? Based on this paradigm, this is how they could justify this. The fact is, we've never gotten there. And thank heavens we haven't gotten there. But the same argument that they use for homosexuality and other deviant practices, why can't they use that? Or I'm just amazed that they haven't used that for committing adultery. In contradiction to the common genetic assertion, the American Psychological Association originally asserted that homosexuality was genetic, and this was back in the early 70s. However, they recently recanted this hypothesis in May of 2009. This recanting was far more secretive than their original assertion, and today in our society, right now in educational courses, children are still being taught that homosexuality is a genetic factor, that you are genetically designed. And so by being told this, the kids just throw up their hands and go, well, okay, I guess I had no choice on this. I guess it's okay for me to do this. Obviously, the APA didn't want to go out of their way to set the record straight, because I think they would have understood it would have undone the damage that they had put in motion, that they wanted to put in motion. One would think that this would have been newsworthy. However, this news has been suppressed by mainstream media since it does not lend to their agenda. Their intent of this original argument was used to generate sympathy and acceptance of the homosexuals. Paradoxically, though sexual freedom was purported to be born under the umbrella of liberal thinking, as we think about this, and as a matter of fact, when we start thinking about sexual freedom and being able to think that, you know, we can do anything and everything we want, just put this into context to the laws of nature and God's laws and an enlightened society. And we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
As I was just saying, so sexual freedom has been kind of reported as being born or its origins from the liberal thinking. Progressive ideologies such as these have been proven as a detriment to society due to the inherent self-interest and self-centered nature and their conflict with natural law as well as God's law. Therefore, these are not liberal in the classic definition because it is a violation of natural and God's law. Such is the way for all special interest groups who seldom care of the cost to or the consequences on society. They only care that their means are implemented to reach their end, and in this case, the end is to eradicate alternate ideas and philosophies of God's law and natural law. You have to, let me put it into this perspective for you, because the example I'm using here is all about homosexuality and sexual deviation, perversion, what have you. But there are many things that you can actually start putting one by one onto this plate we call enlightenment. Is smoking cigarettes something that an enlightened person would do? With all of the empirical data and understanding the damage that you will be inflicting and potential damage you do to others, as well as the damage to society in the production of tobacco, is that an enlightened decision? And are you an enlightened person for drinking, smoking, for doing any of the, look at the behaviors that we're doing today. I talk about this and how the children in our education system, it's not just focused on the sexual deviation because they know that that's only a certain percentage of the children that they can ill advise, or I should say, what's the best word for this? Influence and destroy, because it's all about what I would call addictive behavior, whether it is gaming, whether it is drugs, whether it is sex. They don't care. As a matter of fact, the education system and those who are out with the curriculum are teaching children that, hey, you know, and I go through this in, you know, in special topics because I talk about why children are being indoctrinated into this behavior. What children are learning in the education system, if you are Christian and you try to have a Christian family, your children are learning that you are the enemy. It may not be a direct word being stated by any teacher or anybody, but the underlying theme that they are learning is they have a right to feel good about what they're doing, and they should be able to enjoy whatever they want. And when you come along and say, this is wrong, this is, you know, this is not enlightenment, this is a violation of natural law, God's law, what have you, then you're taking away their opportunity to be, have a good time, to be able to indulge in, you know, their own desires and basically drown themselves with these addictions. Because of the effects of open sexual freedom on society has, one can see the consequences of this violation of natural law, where one cannot physically procreate and build a family in their, quote, chosen, close quote, state. Again, one must subvert natural law to acquire the desired outcome. Humans are capable of comprehending the consequences of their action when they engage in behavior that violates natural law and God's law. They are, in essence, in the act of denying these laws. Again, humans differ from all other animals due to cognitive capabilities and understand the consequences of their decisions. To emphasize what individual liberty is in society, again, is that it is congruent to freedom with responsibility and accountability. As I stated before, there is a symbiotic relationship between your freedom of choice or your agency and responsibility and accountability. Therefore, the result of humans trying to free themselves from the consequences of their choice only ends up destroying individual liberties. Paradoxically, secular progressives used freedom as a portal to commit this atrocity and are counting on an immoral society to give them a pass, not understanding the consequences. If you look at what money we spend as a society in indulging what we call sin, and so I know there's people that drink and they, you know, I don't drink to an excess. The question is, do you drink for survival, for the betterment, or is it just a variety thing? Is it good? There is no doubt in my mind that is proven scientifically that alcohol in any form ingested is a toxin. It kills brain cells. It is not anything that would be considered a nutrient. I believe that we need to free the encumbrance of society so that everybody can do what they want, but you have to pay the consequences. In other words, like I've said this before, if you smoke, you don't get health care to cover for what you've done to your body. If you engage in, you know, sex in any degree, you know, how many billions of dollars get spent each year on trying to cure and help prevent sexually transmitted diseases? There are people that are dying, and, oh, it's only a compassionate society that tries to solve this problem. I disagree. I believe it is a blinded society that allows people to head down this path of saying, you know, how I feel is far more important than, you know, my life itself. You know what? They say that at the front end, and when they're dying, they say, boy, was I wrong. Almost 100% of the time. You have to be a very stubborn, hard-headed person to not say, wow, was I wrong. And the impact that they have on society and the damage that they do to our enlightenment, it's hard to fathom. I am here to tell you that enlightenment and natural law really do go hand in hand, because we can obtain a much higher happiness in society. Are you more happy when you are drunk or high or engaged in whatever euphoric thing you're doing than you are when you witness, you know, an accomplishment of a loved one, your child, being able to, you know, accomplish their degree, or seeing somebody, or even when you have learned to trade and have become self-reliant. You have the ability to pay for your own house and your own food instead of being dependent on your parents. We trifle the important things in life, and we build and magnify those things that destroy us. And that is not an enlightened society. I mean, look at how outrageous the gaming industry is. When I say gaming, I'm not talking about gambling. Gambling is its own problem. But kids and people that are stuck and addicted to their games and their online interaction, like, I don't know what to say. I'm just going, we are at a tipping point as far as society goes. And I truly believe this is one of the reasons why there are just so many people that are apathetic and they just don't care. Come on. Okay, well, maybe you shouldn't be voting. Let's start looking at things pragmatically. If you don't understand the issues, if you don't understand why these things are important, then maybe you should leave it to those and kind of go back to the framers era. Look at how well society was, was based and was heading when they had and embraced Enlightenment philosophies. It's not that they didn't have gambling back then. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson played a little bit in gambling, but he didn't want to squander his life and money by being consumed in it. He just said, what a waste of time and money. I could be doing far more greater things. And he was absolutely right. My friends, if we start putting into context what and the importance of natural law, you will actually start recognizing that anything that is contrary to, you know, anything that would shorten your life, anything that would be contrary to helping you both cognitively, both emotionally, and, you know, in every aspect of your life, financially, in every aspect, and you're doing something that is a detriment to any of those things or all of those things, then you are not living by natural law, nor are you, you know, living within these concepts of enlightenment. And so there's a way to get back to that. It's going to be a long, slow turn, because the progressives over the past 140 years, probably 140, they have been very, very successful in getting us into embracing debauchery and these concepts of living life, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And so what we want to get into in our next episode, because literally we're out of time as I speak, we're going to get into republicanism, the definition of republicanism, and American republicanism, because this was what was introduced at the Constitutional Convention. So then we can start going into the ratification debates. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.